Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Mango Dogs TV. I am your host, Lee. I am joined by my co-host, Spencer. Spencer, how are you today, sir?
Feeling obliged to talk about Last of Us in very Game of Thrones-y terms after this episode.
Yeah, it was wild. You know, we said at the first episode of our coverage of the season that we would do two long-form episodes, and we would want to do the finale and then a big episode in the middle. This clearly was the big episode in the middle. I just couldn't have predicted it was episode two. I wish we were doing the long-form episode for this one. We're not, because we didn't prepare for it. There's a host of reasons. Our schedules won't allow it this week, but this was the big one, I feel like. I mean, I don't know how it gets much bigger. You know, we talked last week. I said they absolutely need to kill Joel. It's important to do it for the story. Damned if they didn't listen. I really appreciate them building it into the story based on what I said in the podcast. RIP Joel. Look at that. Yeah, goodbye, Joel.
It's really impressive in this AI generating world how quickly they can adapt to your advice in terms of writing and producing and getting out a proper spectacle of television. It's legitimately amazing.
I mean, a really compelling episode of television. And, you know, they did the big character death, which I thought they were going to end up doing. And now it's interesting to see where it goes from here. What did you think of the episode?
I thought it was a very good hour of television. I mean, it felt like, I'm referring to it in Game of Thrones terms, but it felt very much like their hard home episode mixed with the death of Ned Stark in terms of both, you know, the spectacle that we got and also the ongoing effect when it comes to the show. And that was very well done. I mean, if I had a complaint about it, and I suppose I do, I might say that I would have preferred if it had been given a little bit more time to breathe or been a little bit later in the season so some of it could have felt a little bit more built up. But I think that was part of the intent. I think it was meant to be shockingly early, to not be perfectly satisfying, to not be a fitting necessarily resolution to a character. I think that's in keeping with the themes that they were going for, so I can't really judge it too much in those terms, other than it might have had a little bit stronger effect on me if we'd had a little bit more time to get more fully immersed in the world before they threw these climactic events at us. But that said, judged on its own terms, it was excellently filmed, it was excellently acted, it was utterly gripping from moment to moment, it was emotionally affecting. I can't frame that as anything other than a remarkably effective television show.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, last week I said I was a little bit bored in the opening
they heard you.
Episode. I was certainly not bored in this one. This was, yeah, you're right. It was gripping. It was compelling. They can't do it every week, right? But when they've built to it and they did it, and I thought they executed it really well, the big attack on Jackson Hole. You know, Abby, is that her name? Abby?
Abby is our... I might refer to her as anti-villain when it comes to other shows.
Hero.
Want to prepare.
Fucking hero. Again, depending is what on your she view. Is. Abby gets her revenge on Joel. And, you know, we go from there. It was a big, big hour of television. Shout out to The Last of Us for executing it. I thought it was really well done. I mean, people do a TV show really well. As they were in the first half of the episode, as they were sort of creeping around different sets, all of which felt very video game. Like, here is a abandoned 7-Eleven and we're walking around and there's interesting things, there's marijuana plants, there's whatever, and we're looking for certain things
where everybody else is holed up, another base, and
we maybe can go there, and we've got, you know, a radio of people talking to us at these weird intermittent periods.
You and your NPC teammate are going to split up, but you're going to reunite at the same location later, trust us, it's fine.
Yeah. I was kind of wondering, you know, does this now have the belt for the greatest television show adaptation? I understand Fallout, video game adaptation. I understand Fallout was really good, but the thing about Fallout to me is that Fallout was a very good television show, but I'm not 100% sure. I can go back and listen to our podcast from that, which I invite you to do. We did cover Fallout, the episode or season one, episode by episode on this podcast channel. I don't know if it felt like I was playing a video game quite like this show. This show really captures the feeling of I am walking around playing a video game like I've maybe never seen before and still manages to be really good television.
Well, I feel like three of the big shows that I mentioned over the last few years of being examples of how well video games can be adapted to the screen are Last of Us, Fallout, and Arcane. I feel like Last of Us, though, is in a unique category of where both Arcane and Fallout aren't directly adapting the video game. They're not, like, hitting the moments of a particular video game or telling the story, whatever else. Fallout is set in the same universe, but it's telling its own unique story, notably set seemingly after the video games. Arcane is following the lore of the video games, but the game itself, League of Legends, does not really tell a story. It's just a massively multiplayer competitive game. Last of Us, though, is a very cinematic video game, and this show is literally adapting it to the screen. And I think that fits something of what you're saying. For the other two, they're telling a story within a video game world. This one, they're actually fitting each of the beats of the video game and putting them on the screen. I think that's inherently going to feel a little bit more gameplay focused, even in an otherwise a very cinematic driven video game like Last of Us. So I think that very much justifies what you're, you know, saying there. This one feels kind of video game about its beats, because I think it's much more closely adapting a particular video game rather than just set in a video game universe the way some other very successful video game adaptations have been.
It's a great point. Because it's following the actual plot of the video game, it feels a little bit more immersive in that type of media. You know, you and I went to MegaCon in February. Shout out. It was a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. You showed up, you showed out, Spencer. It's a classic Spencer performance. We all really appreciated it. And one of the things that happened there is I was listening to an interview with one of the Arcane actors. And
really?
Yeah, voice actors. And I can't remember the lady's name, but she was saying that she was told specifically by the showrunner not to play League of Legends before. Don't learn anything about it. Basically, ignore the fact that there is a connection to the League of Legends game and just come in cold. And when she said that, the audience erupted in cheers because I guess of how the audience knows how different it is than the show or than the video game.
The League of Legends gameplay community is a wonderfully self-hating. It's like how lawyers love lawyer jokes. League of Legends fans love to rag on League of Legends more than anyone else known to man, particularly the fandom. So them saying, hey, don't actually play the game or do anything with respect to that, and laughing and cheering that, is very in keeping with that community.
Yeah, I thought it was weird, right? Because I don't know anything about it, but when I heard that, I was like, oh, I guess that, you know, they know that there's not a connection here between these two things. But yeah, back to Last of Us, I feel like it just, beat by beat, feels like I'm immersed in a video game. And they executed I think that, you know, the piece with Abby and Joel was good. It was interesting. I expected it. I thought she'd kill him. If she didn't kill him, I would have thought, this is just bad writing, because she should have. I felt like the greatest part, the best execution in this episode was the big battle sequences. I thought those were done really, really well.
Let's talk about those two separately, because I feel like they are very much an A plot and a B plot that are, they work hand in hand. The battle is in many ways meant to be a distraction, or meant to be something that keeps our characters, you know, separate and divided apart from each other. But they are their own distinct plot lines that only come vaguely overlap. So which one would you like to talk about first? The big battle spectacle or the death of the hero, as it were?
Before we go, you were in a bad mood last week. Do you want to apologize to me?
No, never. Never have, never will. I mean, the fact you even ask is wonderful effort at futility.
It's one of my favorite things to do in my friendship with Spencer is to say, Spencer, blah, 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 blah. Do you want to apologize to me? No, I don't think I do. No, I don't believe that I do.
If you want to apologize to me later for the gall of asking for me to apologize, we could have that discussion. But for right now, we'll continue as we were.
I'll come back to the pod if he ever says yes. I'd like to apologize. It'll be a break. It'll be like an emergency pod. We'll hop on and do it really quick. Last week, I talked about the fact that I had lost my dog. So thank everybody who wrote in and was very kind and nice to me about that. they were super nice, Spencer. They were so nice that they did not talk about the mouse clicking in the background that I think one of our hosts maybe were doing. I got no complaints about background noise, even though we had some background noise. And I got people writing and saying, you know, thank you for sharing about your dog and wishing me really positive vibes. And so I just want to shout out our listeners for being really kind this week to us. That was really awesome of you guys to do that. Thank you for writing in. I am ready to announce to our podcast audience here today, Spencer's breaking news, that we do have another dog in the house. We have gotten another.
You guys already went ahead.
We have adopted another dog. Yes, we
did.
It is a lemon beagle. So a beagle that is, it's like a rare breed of beagle. It is a rescue. We got it from a beagle rescue organization, really great organization here in North Carolina. And he's about 5 years old. He is wonderful. We've named him Conroy. His name was a little bit in flux through the rescue part of his life. And so we're settling on Conroy. So we've got Conroy here. He is a white and light brown, beagle, and he's fantastic. So, we are going to commit our efforts and, focus our grief for our other dog on taking care of this dog and trying to give it a good life. So that is the news on the dog front. The only other podcast news we have is that I'm doing another podcast right now called As the Wheel of Time Turns. You can go find that podcast on mangotalks.com or just your favorite podcast platform, As the Wheel of Time Turns. We are covering season 3 of Wheel of Time. Spencer, it's so good. They have leveled up the show. It has gotten better. We're in the home stretch. We are the last two episodes that we are reviewing is the next 2 weeks, episode 7, episode 8 of season 3. And that may be the end of the show. They have not renewed it for season 4 yet. So yeah. Please join us over there and listen to that podcast. But the matter at hand, Spencer, the matter for us is to talk about this fucking banger of an episode here of The Last of Us. And you have set up the question to me, which do I want to talk about first? The A-plot, which I'm going to go ahead and say is Abby and Joel because of the implications long-term for the plot. And the B plot, sure, which is the attack on Jackson Hole. I want to talk about the attack on Jackson Hole first.
Understood. Well, I have to ask, in terms of a quality of spectacle, we'll go into the particular details of how the plot works everywhere else. Where does this rank for you? Did the spectacle astound? Did it lose you at certain moments? How successful was this for its intended purpose of being lights and fury before we even get into its overall role in the story?
So it didn't, I didn't have the moments of like scale where I was startled by scale. Like I've gotten in some things, like, there was a spate of like from about, what is it, 2005 to about 2013 or 14, where they just made a whole bunch of war movies set in like ancient Rome.
Sure.
And you know, it was like, oh, well, now we're going to do the Iliad. Now we're going to do, you know, and it's like, like 20, 30, 50,000 soldiers on the battlefield. I got that a little bit in the last two Lord of the Rings movies too, where they really went for scale. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that was like breathtaking and startling. They didn't do quite the same scale here, but it was incredibly immersive and effective. There was nothing in the presentation that took me out of it that I can recite to you now. I thought it all looked realistic, felt realistic. And I liked that they grounded it in Joel's brother, Tommy. I like that they grounded it in Tommy. And there was the stuff that you want in these big battle sequences. There was Tommy defending the wall. There was him breaking away, trying to save his loved one, a one-on-one battle with the big final boss type character. You know, and then the sort of cleanup at the end where, you know, the here are the winners, but did they really win scene, right? Mm-hmm. That is always so great in war. I thought it was really effective, and I give it a lot of high marks. What did you think?
I'm very much on the same boat. I mean, just from a visual effects standpoint, it was very well done. I was impressed that it was done during daylight. So many of these are done at night to cover up little issues, to deal with budget issues. This was filmed during the day, and most of the shots looked great. There's some moments with the bloater, the big dude, that were obviously CGI put in, whatever else, but they weren't too distracting or anything else. But I'm with you that one of the things that I think made it in some ways more effective, though, that wasn't over the top necessarily. It was a community of competent, determined, prepared individuals fighting for their homes. And the fact that it was on that kind of intimate scale and then very much grounded in Tommy and Maria in terms of his wife.
Maria.
And their leadership and their how much they've guided this community, I think made it work better that it wasn't just, you know, the scale of Helm's Deep or the scale of defending Minas Tirith. Or even within the context of, say, like Game of Thrones, like The Long Night or something like that. This felt more, the fact that it was smaller in some ways, I think, still worked better, while at the same time very much impressing in terms of how they went about doing it. With you mentioning dogs, was the fact that, you having a new dog, was the fact that the dogs proved the metaphorical cavalry at the end of the story in terms of riding to the rescue, did that particularly tickle you?
I cried. I was crying, but I've been crying all week. But yeah, I started crying because I loved, I don't know, man, anytime there's one of these stories and dogs fight on behalf of humans, I can understand how some people might think that's not realistic or hokey or they don't care or the dogs are expendable or whatever, but there's this like universal beauty. There's this sublime thing to,
it's primal. It's our oldest relationship with another species right there.
Exactly. Yeah. There's this like natural connection and beauty that I feel to that of these creatures willing to sacrifice themselves on behalf of a very imperfect humanity. Right. Mm-hmm. And laying it out there and those dogs fucking rolling in and they probably all died. Right. Doing this. Not so incredible.
Not clear. I mean, it seemed like at the moment they released, in some ways it was like not necessarily the cavalry breaking a well-formed enemy formation, but it's the cavalry hitting the enemy when they're already starting to thread, when they're already starting to fall apart. Because our defenders at Jackson Hole did remarkably well, which is one of the things I love about the episode, is that I'm a sucker for what's a genre called competence porn, of where it's seeing people being very capable at just doing something they're good at and watching them do it. Like, The West Wing is at times referred to as being politics competence porn, in terms of seeing remarkably skilled individuals go about the process of their jobs and their works and anything else. This show, this episode felt like that sometimes when it came to the defenders of Jackson Hole, of where they had a plan, they had a fallback plan. We got it already set up even before things started what aspects of that plan were, and we got to see them implemented. They adjusted to things that were beyond their control with preset already arrangements. When things started to go hell, they still had a further plan to go from there. It wasn't just, you know, a very skilled individual that kind of wings it. You could clearly see that these guys had all worked together for this common purpose and had trained for it, and we got to see that in action. So getting to see that performed live was really well done, and each of that steps and it being believable. At times, HBO shows love to do that thing where the main character gets lost in a crowd of people and somehow survives, which I rolled my eyes a little when that happened a couple times in the episode, but didn't take me out of it too much just because it's very much an HBO trope at this point. But both the defense of the wall and then the defense from the roofs and then the defense, you know, from various people having to fight on the ground, they killed a lot of infected and really broke the back of the tide, even before my mind, before the dogs came. The dogs were necessary to provide the impetus to finally drive things back, but it didn't feel like the dogs were being used necessarily as a suicide squad, more than as a coup de grace to finally wipe out the enemy. At least in my view.
Competence porn is such a bizarre name to give what you were just describing. I'm trying to think of what competence porn would be.
It's an online term, but yes, I accept that it is weird.
Like maybe like a database of videos of people like fixing HVAC systems.
Oh, my kink right there summarized. Well done.
Yeah. Yeah. Or doing like some like at home plumbing work where they like know how to turn the water off effectively in their home first.
God, is he redoing his roof by himself? Be still my heart.
This man's checking the weather report in winter and he's dripping his pipes. He's letting pipes run so that they don't freeze. What a competent person.
Is this man giving advice on where to put your money in your 401k during economic turmoil? What is happening right now?
This person can fold a fitted sheet. Who can do that?
He can fold a towel or put a pillow in a pillowcase without using his chin. Dear God.
Oh man. This man can get sugar to dissolve in lemonade when the water's cold. How can you do that? It's fantastic.
We can keep doing that forever, but I think we've had enough examples right now of that particular thing. But
no, I think I got a few more. Yeah. No, competence porn, bizarre name. I get what you're saying though. I maintain it's hard to make lemonade. It's not
properly.
Easy.
The balance easy to, is always off.
Very difficult. And you almost reach oversaturation with the sugar. I'm so distracted by competence porn. Can you tell? It's very difficult for me to get back into this.
Well, I like as well how well they did in terms of characterizing unnamed characters. But there's such a tendency to make people that aren't, you know, a key part of the plot, or you don't even have a name, just irrelevant. They're just fodder. They're just people that die. This episode did so well at characters we'd never met, that we may never meet again. They're just inhabitants of this community, but giving them a role. Getting to see the people when the first moment that they saw that the pipes had been filled with cordyceps, sprint to go deliver a message immediately. Getting to see the guy on the wall realize the problem and order the bell to be rung. Or particularly near the end, getting to see people that had been bit calmly show it and give a gun to their friends to kill them. That did so well of setting up just the nature of this community and the people that live in it, just through one individual scenes. We didn't need a speech, they didn't even need dialogue, but we got to see people and understand how much of a community has really been created by the effort of Tommy, by the effort of Maria, by the effort of these shared individuals trying to fight through an otherwise apocalyptic world. It's another thing I want to emphasize, just how well this episode did for hitting those notes for me.
So I agree with what you just said. So if you like competence porn, were you into the Bill storyline from last season? I feel like that was like 40 minutes of just somebody being really effective at preparing for the zombie like apocalypse. And you got like a very long period of it. And then we sort of reintroduce it here with like, okay, if you take that same mindset of somebody has time, resources to prepare and they are not preparing to hunker down, right, and shelter in place, as much as what you're seeing is how did they prepare for war, kind of the same thing that they're showing you here.
Yeah, there's about a 20-minute period in that Bill episode where it's just seeing him build his community, where I had a triple of Lagavulin and was very happy with my day.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah, I agree with you, though. I had a similar thought when they were like, you know, roofs and basements. Right? When I was mm-hmm. hearing that going through, roofs and basements, and the fire with the oil. And, you know, it was great. And it's, you know, I think if you think about the last season of Game of Thrones, the big night, the battle at night mm-hmm. At Winterfell, there's a very specific thing that happened, which I was just really disappointed because I liked the episode. And I wanted people to like the last season and they didn't. It was when they had the Dothraki army
charge.
And the Unsullied, the Dothraki outside and the Unsullied army outside of some battlements that they had to protect the wall. They had some mm-hmm. spikes to protect the wall from the zombies, basically. And they had people stand outside of them, which makes no sense, right? It doesn't make any sense when you have, you know, spikes there before palisades that we have before the wall. You don't put people in front of that. You would stand behind it.
Unless that you really type don't of, like them.
That type of thing, we just didn't see here. We didn't see it. I don't, you know, I agree with you that Tommy going through the
charging
the zombies
through the
and struggling and, you know, being sort of affected and shooting randomly and still surviving. It is a very HBO trope at this point, but it also felt very video game to me. It also, mm-hmm. I had the thought to me, like, man, I'd have died like four or five times trying to get through this level. Like you have to just keep restarting because Tommy's put in an impossible situation. So I forgive it a little bit based on the genre is what I'm saying.
One thing I also like too, we're talking about, you know, how much we were impressed by the humanities tactics. I also very much liked how the infected's tactics, I say tactics with air quotes, how the hive mind directs its minions, were very much in keeping of what the show has taught us to understand about them, of where we've seen before about how much they can survive underground. We saw that back in the episode in, what was it, St. Louis?
Yeah.
We saw, you know, hordes of them surviving underground for years, but then coming out in mass and overwhelming, you know, established troops. We got to see how much better the defenders of Jacksonville did compared to that. We've gotten to see previously that they, through the various tendrils of the cordyceps, can receive stimuli and communicate it miles away in terms of being able to direct its minions into action, send them as a horde to confront humanity. We've gotten to see that the cordyceps can spread out over vast areas looking for that kind of stimuli to then send back to its hordes. And it seemed to be implied here that, you know, over the last 30 years or whatever else, the cordyceps has been spreading out trying to find further biomass that it can continue to infect whatever else. And it only now recently, maybe by warmth, maybe by other factors that are drawing it to it, has reached close enough to this community to send a stimuli back to various hordes, or even slowly move those hordes closer to it to launch this general attack. And, you know, Abby may have stirred the hive, but it really did seem like it was not until they broke that pipe and all the various tendrils suddenly all turned in one direction that the horde then descended on Jaxtel. They may have been looking for it for years, the hive mind, as it were. It seems like it wasn't really until that moment that it really was springing its trap and throwing its full forces to bear. So you're going to see that. You're going to see a bloater break through things, then use that. We've gotten to understand over the first episode that there are intelligent individuals, maybe. We're not certain how that works. But getting to see the hive mind in action before, and being in some ways to predict kind of how things would flow based on what the show's already established, that's just well done writing, that we have a great, good enough understanding of the world to already anticipate and already not be caught completely off guard by how a character, as it were, the cordyceps, behaves when it's confronted by things.
Yeah. What did our 43rd president say? Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, fool man.
Oh, George.
Fool man can't get fooled again, I think is what he said. Same. Look, three examples now for the residents that are left of Jackson. You've got, you know, the Ellie example where she comes back and swears up and down. Ellie, not, you know, she will bullshit you to get what she wants, but not prone for, you know, just fabricating stories for no reason and going about her life. Like you probably mm-hmm. can rely that some of what she's telling you there was true. She comes back to it, says that she ran into an intelligent infected. You've got the cordyceps trying to break into the town, going through the water pipes to try to get mm-hmm. there. Then you have the sequence that I think only Tommy was really noticing, which was the infected started
redirected.
The infected started to run toward the area that the bloater was going to target before the bloater targeted it. The bloater was on the way and the infected were running to the bloater before the bloater hit the wall. It'd be one thing if the bloater hit the wall, broke through, and then they started to storm. They were running before that. That fool man can't get fooled again, Spencer. That's three times. Something there is an intelligence here that they don't understand, that they need to look into or at least assume is there.
I 100% agree. I think this even
get
this
Tommy episode, on the phone, could you? I need to talk to him about this.
Tommy's going to be very busy for the next while rebuilding this community as well as they did. And I love that they survived. I love that they overcome it. It was hard. They clearly suffered heavy losses. The process of rebuilding the town is going to be a struggle. But they did persevere. There is a hope for humanity in this world, even beyond simply vaccines, beyond defeating the cordyceps on those kind of scientific terms. Just sheer human will, as the episode establishing, can overcome. And that's it's something I need. It's something I look for in this universe. I like the episode also established within itself various data about how this works that then we got to see play out, of where we heard from... God, what's his name? What's the name of Ellie's and Dina's friend that was previously dating Dina, the one that she rides out?
Oh, I can't remember that guy's name. I'll look it up.
You look it up.
Yep.
When he points out that, oh, well, another scouting party found some frozen ones on the surface and then like 30 came up from underneath, we think they're maybe using it for insulation or something along those lines. That linked up with what we'd realized before about them being able to survive underground or being able to link up with each other and only a few endure to keep the other ones going.
Jesse,
it seems like this is just a further evolution of what we've already understood about how the cordyceps is willing to use its cannon fodder to sacrifice hundreds for the sake of keeping a larger whole alive, or even just keeping a little bit of itself going. And it's almost like they've been inching slowly under the ground or underneath the snow to get to a destination, freezing crops on top of the surface with each cap, so as to keep those underneath well prepared for when the moment they finally find what their ultimate target is in terms of the city of Jackson. It's fun too. I actually looked it up because I was trying to remind myself about the real city of Jackson, Wyoming. I've been there twice and always referred to it as Jackson Hole. That's not actually the name. It's Jackson, Wyoming. It's just in Jackson Hole Valley. And like in the show, they're both referring to it as Jackson and Jackson Hole because apparently everybody does that. So, little side bit of note
there. Interesting. We've done it too. I've called it both Jackson and Jackson Hole in the course of the podcast because they were doing that. They were going back and forth with it. Thank you for Googling that for us. I really like Jesse as a character. I thought his interactions with Ellie were great and genuinely funny. Although, you know, it was kind of cool to get a little bit of that loose, like the last couple episodes, getting Ellie at least as loose or as fun and fun loving as you can get that character before it goes off a cliff. Now you're never going to get it again. I'm fairly certain of it, but the last couple of episodes, we got a little bit of that before this highly traumatizing thing occurs. And I'm sure that she's just going to go on a revenge tour.
It was one of the things that really synced me with the episode. I liked the first episode, but I was a little lukewarm on it at times. Cause I felt in some ways, some aspects of it felt a bit stilted, maybe in terms of the interaction between the characters. It didn't fully sync with me. One of the earliest moments we get in this episode is Jesse going to wake up Ellie.
Yeah.
And from pretty much that moment forward, it's like, oh, these feel like living, breathing people again.
Yeah.
Well done.
Yeah,
his banter with Ellie.
Yeah.
I love his banter with Ellie. It felt very real. It felt very natural. I also like it bypassed several tropes and even had fun with respect to them. Of where he opens with, you know, how dare you do that kind of, well, you know, talk what you did last night kind of thing. And she assumes that it's, I kissed your ex-girlfriend. I'm sorry. And he goes, no, I was talking about something else. But the fact that you did that, oh my God, that's unforgivable. And it plays into a joke of where he already knows and goes through there else. I like that they basically sped run various tropes the audience might assume that they're going to click into. And it felt very much like, oh, these two are buddies and I'm really getting to see that play out.
Right before you'll never get to see it play out again with Ellie. Because
they're never going to be the
what
same,
you're going to see with Ellie now is going to be horrific. But yeah, I also thought that I specifically said that Tommy and Maria were not working for me last episode because I didn't understand their purpose in the story because their struggle the thing that they were dealing with felt like it wasn't remotely connected to the main plot. Well, you know how you connect it, Spencer? You have the whole town get fucking attacked by zombies, and then now everybody's in the same lifeboat again.
Get them be the leaders. Fantastic. Get to see them in their positions. Good. And how that plays out. That was very well done.
Tommy worked for me this episode.
Tommy worked for me great.
And I'll tell you that it did not work for me until he ran out of the propane or whatever, the tank. I guess it was propane. And he didn't have a plan B. If he had immediately started pulling out gun, knife, and been perfect and killed it and then went on, I'd have been like, it's too much. It's too much for me. This guy, he presented to me now, you look at the whole episode now in retrospect, he presented to me as somebody, like you said, who was very prepared, but not perfect. He had multiple things he was prepared to do. He did them. They did not work. And he was ready to die because he ran out of options. And that is realistic in a way that you don't often get in these war sequences in movies.
Yeah, what I didn't want in that scene was for him to pull, to use more Game of Thrones references, an Arya Stark and knife the Night King. I did not want that. I didn't want him to just summon a magic way to save himself. The fact that it was a certain degree of serendipity, that he fought as hard as he could and then was out of options and was visibly afraid and not certain what was going to happen next, was so delightfully human.
Yep.
In terms of watching that character play out. And then even when he, you know, being a leader, but then is suddenly on tilt when he sees that the bloater, which I think is what the big guys are called.
Yeah, called bloaters.
Is focusing on his wife, and he goes on tilt and dedicates himself to that purpose. Even though it was a little bit unrealistic that he's charging through the crowd, that still felt very human, that as much as he's dedicated to the purpose of his community, similar to his brother, he's still going to hone in on the one person he really cares about, damn everything else to hell, including his own well-being.
I have a moral question for you.
Please.
Would you have released the dogs?
Would I have released the dogs in that moment? Yes. We got to see how effective the dogs were. I don't think they can be infected. I think only humans can really be infected. So the only real risk they have is being, you know, torn apart by the same things the rest of the humans are. If they were winning, it's a great way to further win. If their back was against the wall, it's a necessary thing because the dogs are otherwise going to be killed in their pens anyway. So I very much agree with Maria's choice then. It seemed like it either turned the tide or just drove home that they were already starting to drive the enemy from the field. So, yeah, I 100% agree with her choice. I like that she, again, had seemed like a clear plan there. She and Tommy are the leaders of this community, but I like that we've gotten to see that they are different aspects of leadership and planning that seem later put into motion.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, I generally would not be okay with it. But to your point, if the infected ran over the town, then the dogs are going to die anyway. And it did seem like she did that as a last resort. It seemed like that was one of the last things that she did in defense of the city is release the dogs. So I'm generally okay with it, unless we get some backstory that they were starving the dogs or something, and then I wouldn't be okay with it. But as long as it was like, you know, these are just animals that were trying to protect the town, that recognized the you know, that their humans were fighting something and went out there and did their best at that sort of last throes of the battle when they looks like they were going to lose, I'm all right with it.
Yeah, and I'll be curious to see going forward. It's a weird thing to call a show like this realistic, but it really, once you accept the one big lie of Cordyceps and how it works, it actually does feel very realistic in terms of each beat of the story. I'm kind of expecting after this episode that this may have earned the town of Jackson, Wyoming, a certain measure of peace. I mean, it seems like they eradicated potentially the infected population of, like, I don't know, from Boise to Cheyenne when it comes to, you know, potential amount of infected that are out there. I'm kind of wondering that by doing this, by surviving this, will there be a certain degree of in-universe, your effort has earned you a peace for a generation to come? Have they got themselves into the 30 years through what they just sacrificed here today? I kind of hope for it. I feel like it would, given the scale of the slaughter they inflicted, it feel like not only story beat appropriate and well-earned, it also feel like it would be a certain nod to realism as well.
Yeah. On your point about realism, you know, John Bradley, who played Sam Tarly in Game of Thrones, he had a quote where he talked about how people were constantly referencing, hey man, you're like, you're stuck on this wall. There's like, you know, it's medieval, middle of winter. You know, you don't have resources and you're still fat, right? You're still overweight. And his line is always, well, we've got dragons and we've got people coming back from the dead and we've got, and the thing that's most unrealistic to you is that I'm overweight. Like, what's wrong with you? And always gets a laugh. Good line, I guess, for an interview, but it shows a fundamental, like, he doesn't understand the genre he's in. Like that, right. That line is like, you may be a great actor, but you're not a storyteller, because that, yes, you can question realism in fantasy. Of course you can. Otherwise there would be no fantasy genre. You have to, you establish the rules, you establish the setting, and then from there, it's got to be realistic or people don't know what the fuck they're watching. So I'm right there with you. I think this show does a really good job of staying, at least so far, relatively realistic about what would happen if this thing occurred. This mm-hmm. You introduce this fiction, and then you say, okay, now sprout forward, in the world. How would that actually work? And I think
that actually tickled back.
I think this show does a good job of it. Do you want to pivot? Do you want to pivot to 1A?
Just one or two last things. It just foundational kind of moments that branches between the two. What did you think of, you are a well-known expert on the subject of HR-induced apologies, in terms of something you're very experienced about and have forced upon other people. In terms of Maria directing Seth to apologize to Ellie, how would you grade that apology? Was it heartfelt? Was it otherwise meeting the necessary standards of complying with business procedures? And how well did it land with Ellie? Those three standards.
So it was solid. So one thing that Maria did is she did not send the meeting invite before the meeting. You know, for the 9:30 apology, you get the team's meeting at 9:29 is a great idea. You don't want somebody to sit and think about that all night. Don't send it the night before. That is a terrible idea. You do it in a public place. I thought that was really mm-hmm. good. Mm-hmm. So that if Ellie wanted to act the fool, it was a little bit harder for her to do so. And you have supplied the lines directly to the person doing the apology. He's reading off a script. That's the way to do it. Don't let him freestyle the apology, because you never know what's going to come out. So, all around well done. Look, very competent administrator of this town. Never questioning Maria's ability to administer the town, other than, it might be time to accept that there's some intelligence behind this thing. Like I'm going to need to see that from her next episode. She's going to need to go, okay, there's something here. We got to start building that into our plans. If she continues to question the intelligence of the cordyceps, then I might have a question. But yeah, seems like a pretty competent administrator. Good overall, good apology. Let me ask you this. As somebody who is known to be really fussy and does not take well to having emotional, personal conversations, or somebody opening themselves up to you, who does shut themselves down immediately when such things occur, can you rate Ellie's performance here and how she handled?
Very Spencer-esque.
And how she handled
not engaging
it.
At all. It's like, I mean, it was to the point that he initially offers a kind of an excuse apology of where he says, I was obviously very drunk.
Yeah, she shut that
right and down. She shuts that down early. Said, oh yeah, people are famously drunk and say things that they'd never thought before in their heads. Very much. That's how that happens. And Maria tries to cut it off, because I'm with you. That felt scripted. That felt like you need to think of an excuse, you need to work with that. And she's like, okay, this is going off script, stop. But I like that Seth tried to meet her in the middle of where, no, you're right. I shouldn't have thought it either. I did. And that's not a right, and it's not appropriate. And there's no excuse for that. And they made you steak sandwiches. And that, I can't imagine what steak sandwiches are worth in this universe, but that's a hell of a bribe right there.
Oh, it's big. I got to imagine. Yeah.
And he actually looked like, when Ellie walked away afterwards, he actually looked at Maria not with like an anger or annoyance or where I can't believe you made me do that. He looked like a little chagrined. It's like, yeah, okay, I'm sorry. But, I hope this works out okay. I want to do everything right. He may well be a bigot. Might well be, given what he said, whatever else. But I think he actually did the right steps. Ellie was not willing to do anything in her power to meet that man in any realm midway, or even acknowledging the apology, whatever else.
Nope.
He said the second part, she just exited the conversation, which is probably the best emotionally that she could do, and she accepted the sandwiches. Something there. But
she didn't accept the sandwiches. It was given to Jesse.
She took the sandwiches and then regifted them. Fair point. That's even worse.
She never took them. Maria took them off the counter and gave them to Jesse.
Oh, that's right. So, even if this hadn't happened and it was just a normal tour, would Ellie ever engage with this guy again? No. Had she ever engaged with him before? No. Is she all the more certain to not do so now? Yes. Will she hold a grudge against him until the end of goddamn time? Also, yes. Is that just quintessential Ellie after 5 years from season one? Also, yes.
I'd like to know a couple. So I thought that the look that he shot Maria as she walked off was, I possibly reading way too much into this, but you know, this is what I'm watching. I'm interpreting. I thought it was somewhat age related. I felt it was, I should know better than this. Like I'm supposed to be the adult.
I should have been the adult.
And I wasn't. And that is part of the thing that he's regretting. But I also wonder how much of that would have occurred if Joel was already gone. Because I wonder how much of it was fear of Joel long-term if he did not get on Ellie's right side, if it was not known that he had apologized. And now that Joel's gone, I wonder, you know, what she'll put up with.
That's an interesting point. We've seen clearly people are not willing to mess with Ellie. I think it's possible. I would prefer it if it wasn't that. I would prefer if it's I'd prefer it if it was a demonstrative of Maria's leadership in terms of bringing the community together, trying to resolve disputes, being the arbitrator and magistrate of this of Jackson, Wyoming. I'm hoping that's what it was, rather than just, dear God, that you have a murder attack dog in your corner who we know is what he's capable of, so I need to make amends with you quickly. I'm hoping it wasn't that. If it was that, yeah, that's no longer a card that Ellie doesn't want to play but also doesn't have in her deck.
Yeah, I feel like it's more realistic that at least there's some fear of Joel going into that, especially since Joel decked him in the fucking moment. Speaking of Joel, let's move to plot 1A. Spencer, RIP Joel, did you cry? Were you affected? Are you upset now?
This is the one thing I got to reveal. This is one of two big plot points that I was spoiled about going into this season. In 2015, when Last of Us Part 2 came out, this was, sorry, Harry Potter spoiler, but an example of something I've been spoiled about in Harry Potter, but I haven't even gotten to yet. This is the equivalent of Snape Kills Dumbledore. In terms of, this was just everywhere, in every internet forum, in every discussion of video games. It was all-encompassing for what this did to people. People were apoplectic about the fact that Abby killed Joel. That's all I really knew. I knew it involved a golf club, and I knew that Abby killed Joel. That's about the limit of my knowledge. I was not expecting it this early.
Yeah.
I thought it was at least going to be like halfway through or whatever else. So I wasn't emotionally affected by shock. Because once they started to get, even when I saw like golf clubs in the background of the mountain retreat, I was like, oh shit, is that happening already? Dear God. The actual beats of it though, they got a great actress to play Abby. She did really goddamn well with those scenes in terms selling me on why is this woman here? Why is she doing something that's utterly alien to who she was before this moment? Maybe the first scene of the episode was the one of when we get to see Abby dreaming and she is imagining herself in the moments before she found her dad's body.
Yep.
And she's confronted by herself who has already seen it. She's confronted by herself, who has now become a different person of the before and after moment of seeing her dad dead. And that was such a wonderfully artistic way of expressing that, of she no longer sees herself as the same person. She's incapable of being the same person. It was too damaging, too traumatic of a moment for her to continue through in anything of what she was before, to the point that even in her own mind and her dreams, she sees herself as two different individuals from the before and after moment. Loved how they did that. And it was very interesting to see in this episode that how much you can imagine that this is not the Abby of 5 years ago, 5 years and one day ago. I think one of the things that also drove that was, curious your thoughts, I loved her friends' reactions to seeing what she was doing. What did you make about how her friends were processing what they saw Abby go through in this episode?
I thought the friends were feckless, and I thought that they were, I have nothing but respect for Abby and what she was doing. That's the character. That's a purpose. That's what she's out to do. I understand it. Joel deserves to get marked. Got it. I'm all on board. But our friends clearly did not like the methods. We're not okay, disturbed. But we're not willing to speak up. You know, Joel made a tactical error. Because what you do in that situation, first off, Joel might have been okay dying. I mean, his headspace is so... He wrapped up in a lot of guilt with this, and he might have just been okay accepting his fate. And if so, that's maybe a good way for him to exit. It probably the only person on the internet saying that getting beaten to death with a golf club was a good way to exit. I might be sure, the only person making that point.
Fine.
Yeah. But the thing to do in Joel's situation is to look at the friends and go, this is who leads you. This is who you follow. You're okay with this? Like, talk to the friends. You're getting nowhere with Abby. As soon as Joel got in that room and Abby got with her friends and I saw her face, I said, okay, the fact that Joel saved her doesn't matter. She's going to kill him. Like, she's still the same person. And he's smart enough to know when he looked at her. Like, that's why he started barking at her, because he was like, it's over. Like, she's going to kill me. Talk to the fucking friends, because the friends were the ones that were starting to break in that whole situation. So I think they were the weak link in the whole thing. They were feckless and they acted it well. I really felt like they were struggling, fumbling. I expected them to call out to stop her. They did not do it. That whole thing was tragic or frustrating in various levels. And so that interplay was great, because you could have done that scene without that dynamic and gotten mm-hmm. it, and it would have been very emotionally impactful. But adding that dynamic in did not make it too much for me. It wasn't overwhelming. I still was able to focus on the fact that our main character was dying. But I felt like it created an additional tension that made the scene more interesting.
It added to what is meant to be the complexity of how we should judge this character from a moral or ethical or just even whether she is a villain or whether she is an antagonist kind of standpoint. Where we got to see in her that we got to have her spell out very clearly why she's here, that you killed my dad and 18 other people. You did so like a fucking Terminator. You did so for no reason that we understand. We treated you fairly. We gave you everything that you wanted. We honored the terms of our contract, and you came through and just went through us like a goddamn hailstorm. All that was spelled out well, so we can just be reminded of Joel's sins. We got to see, as you said, Joel react to it. When she spells all this out, Joel's reaction is literally to just kind of nod at her. It's like, yeah, I get it. It's like, I'm not going to try to rebut you right now. I'm not going to try to justify what I did. I'm acknowledging myself and just admitted that, you know, what I did was all sorts of messed up and difficult to justify from any outside perspective. From my own motivations, probably would totally do it again, because that was Ellie and I'm going to do anything for her because she is my daughter, whether in reality or not. But you coming to get yours for what I did, I have no response to that. Do what you need to do. Just stop the monologuing. And then having her friends react to it is a delightful in-universe acknowledgement of, we got Joel, the guy who committed the sin, saying, yeah, you've got a right to seek your revenge. But we also have her friends who know this woman flinching away from the actual process of it. And so it's almost like it was an in-universe acknowledgement of whether you want to see what she's doing as having any degree of justification or not. How she's going about it is not in a healthy, not in a reasonable, not in a controlled kind of place.
No, I would say not. I'm looking up the Nietzsche quote that's like, you know, in searching for the monster, don't become the monster sort of thing. Because the tragedy here, and it's nail head, you know, they're just whacking it, is that she does the exact same thing that Joel does.
You know, cycles of revenge.
She did the exact same, you know, she killed a dad in front of the daughter. And the daughter had to see the dad dead, and she leaves the daughter,
abandons her there
with the corpse of the father in the same way that she was abandoned with the corpse of her. She does the same exact fucking thing. But Joel I've covered on this podcast, I stand by it. Joel was absolutely wrong to do what he did. And the fact that he got some bit of a lot of punishment for that in this world that is now, you know, broken down, it's post-apocalyptic, it's lawless, does not necessarily bother me. But the way that Abby did it, obviously, is going to come back.
Not a healthy place.
Well, it's not healthy. Yeah, I like that your diagnosis there. We can all agree that how Abby did
it. Killing someone with golf club.
Was not. But the dumbest thing she did is leave Ellie alive, obviously, because Ellie's going to find that girl and is going to fucking murder her. I mean, I have no doubt in my mind that Ellie will find Abby and it will be fucking on. Spencer, it will be night two WrestleMania situation when Ellie gets Abby, and I think that Ellie will kill Abby eventually. That is my guess.
One thing I like too
is it cycles, right? That's the storytelling. It's like the ball is, it's Pong. The ball is back by whacking back and forth. And you know, it also, sorry to cut you off, but I was going to finish this thought. It's also like the idea of what propels performance, like what motivates performance and revenge, and that sort of like tunnel vision of revenge does propel really high elite human performance, you know, over time. And it clearly did in Abby, in marshaling the resources and going that long distance and finding Joel and executing this plan. And I think now that you're going to have a single focused Ellie, it's realistic to me that she'll be able to find and kill Abby.
Build off two things you said. One, in terms of Joel processing this and how we view that, whatever else. To link that with last episode, I in some ways feel like his last moments talking to Abby were the completion of his therapy, of where, as the therapist prompted him to do, he admitted his sins to the person he hurt most. He accepted a certain degree of punishment or responsibility for it, and he went to it willingly. There is, in some ways, he completed an arc there for the character, which is an interesting exit to him. It's not necessarily satisfying. The key aspect of his character is in terms of his relationship with Ellie, and I'm left to ponder whether the two of them patch things up or whether... either they patch things up off screen when we thought Ellie was going to bed, or it's just an utter tragedy that they never got to have their time to do so. Don't know. I'm kind of leaning in favor of the latter, but I'm not really sure I'd necessarily process some of the things that we got to see with Ellie and Jamie early in the episode. But point number one there about Joel kind of completing an aspect of his own character growth with that. Point number two, I'm with you. The cycles of revenge feels like it's going to be very much the theme of this season. And I'm wondering what opportunities for an off-ramp the show has already presented. Of where... Thing number one we got to see, talked about in this episode was Eugene. Of where Eugene was a Firefly. Eugene... I'm saying that name right. The guy, the husband
that's
of the...
That's right, Eugene. Yeah, growing out of the pot in 7-Eleven.
And the husband of the therapist. We heard in this episode, he was a Firefly. He was a Vietnam vet. He was a Firefly. He got tired of murdering people. And he left, and he set up a community. He joined a community, and he dedicated himself to it, and he enjoyed years of peace. The universe itself and the violence of the world eventually came back to hurt him in some ways, regardless of his actions, but he found a measure of peace by stepping away. You get to see that in Joel, too. In some ways, it may have led up to his death, but Joel, for the last 5 years, really seemed like he had a bit of a character arc off screen. Before he became dedicated to the community, he started to care about other people. He wasn't just always focused on the immediate... own interests and, you know, damned be everybody else. He was one of the lead contractors. We get to see him excited to see and enjoy people other than just Ellie. In some ways, it may have led to his death, that he didn't let his guard down to trust somebody he'd not met before in terms of rescuing a random person that's out in the wilderness.
Well, I mean, what the fuck is the likelihood? I mean, unbelievable luck for Joel.
But Joel of last season would have done nothing to rescue that woman. Probably. Maybe from what not. We got to see.
I had that thought too about like comparing what we saw when he's sitting behind the table saying like, oh, well, we can't build fast enough because of all these very realistic issues in construction versus the guy who was getting like day drunk on a mattress, you know, in Boston or whatever. He did grow for sure. It's a great point.
And the fact that his sins came back to punish him, the fact that he accepted that in some ways is in no way a condemnation of the choice that he made to try to grow, to try to escape, to try to evolve. We got to see a happier Joel at the start of the season, even though he separated from Ellie, than we'd ever gotten to see back in season one because he'd actually taken the opportunity to step away from the various cycles of violence or whatever else. I think the show is laying out that a person can escape the pathways they've set themselves on, violence associated or not, whether that will be a future for Ellie and gang. And I'm assuming that Ellie, Jamie, and Dina are going to ride off into the sunset with murder in their hearts. Maybe. You think Tom... This question for you. You think Tommy's going to go with them, or you think he's going to stay and try to rebuild Jackson?
I think Tommy will stay. I think it will be... Yeah, I think it'll be the three. It'll be, you know, Jesse, Dina, and...
Jesse, thank you.
Yeah, Jesse, Dina, and Ellie. And it's interesting that you make that point, which is you can escape the cycle of violence. You can step out of it. Eugene is an example.
Maybe only for so long.
Because I think we're about to see someone who will not be able to do that. I think what we're going to see with Ellie is going to be really dark and upsetting, because I think that this girl is broken. This young woman is broken, and mm-hmm. there's no coming back for her is my prediction there. I do think, though, I opened this door because I threw out the possibility that maybe Joel, like, this was, he was okay with going this way. And then you kind of like took it and you were like, yeah, he kind of accepted his fate. And he was like, okay. He was like, and like, I mean,
you wouldn't go that far.
I don't know. I mean, like, he was tied up. Like, I mean, here's the thing. If she take the gun off him, undo his cuffs, and see how accepting he is. Like, I'm not sure he'd be that accepting.
He would have killed five people just spraying the room. Right.
So maybe not that accepting. But what? I think, you know, as it's starting to happen, there did seem to be a look on his face of like, I do deserve this. And with everything we got from him after that action, it did seem mm-hmm. like the guilt sort of stayed with him.
I think the show set that up well. A question... just a random bit of trivia. Did you notice, you watch with subtitles, right?
Yeah, most of the time.
Did you see, they sang a song over the course of Ellie lying and crying on top of Jill's body, which was very well done by Bella Ramsey in terms of that. Did you see who the artists were, by the way, that were singing it?
No, just in the valley. I didn't see the artists, no.
One of the main ones was Ashley Johnson. That is the voice actress that plays Ellie in the game.
Oh, wonderful. Shout out. I like that they did that.
I like that the show keeps bringing back the original people there.
Yeah, that's cool. I like that. I like that tie-in.
What else do we have in my notes here? Question I kind of set up. I'm curious your thoughts on that conversation that Ellie had with Jesse. Do you think that she and Joel talked again that night, or do you think that she in private just kind of had a moment of, no, I need to fix things up with Joel. I'll go out with him today.
I don't think that they talked again that night, because the way that she explains it to Jesse is, you know, we're always going to be good. It doesn't matter what we say. He's still Joel. I'm still Ellie. And it is what it is. And we're always going to be that way. And we're always going to be good.
I've processed this.
Yeah. She's trying to explain to him, like, we're never that far apart, even if we're bickering, because that's how she thought of it. And she was going to go on patrol with him. Like, I know that she'll feel guilt about the way that they ended, but I don't think that she should, because I think that her heart was sort of in the right place with him, and I don't think he remotely felt like she didn't love him or whatever. You never know when people are going to die, right? Or you usually don't. So she shouldn't hold herself to a cord for that, but you know that she will. You know that'll be a part of this weird guilt, anger, vengeance thing that we're going to get from Ellie. And it's intriguing to watch. I do sometimes feel like standard television writing is so predictable that the only time we get shit like this is when it's a different medium that bleeds into television, right? When it's like, mm-hmm. when it's a book, when it's, you know, based on a video game, where if this was like the Fallout model, right, where it wasn't following the video game script, instead it was just some whole cloth thing that they were writing for TV. There's no way they kill the main character in the second episode of the season. There's no way written for TV does that. And it was so good. So I'm really, mm-hmm. TV just got, please learn this lesson that sometimes you have to upend a script and just do something like this to shock your audience. And it's so entertaining.
I'm with you in terms of, I 100% agree with you there. That's as much as I'm saying that, man, I wish it was a little bit later. It wouldn't probably have worked as well if it was like episode 5. Because by that point, I would have been anticipating it coming to a certain degree. The fact that it happened in episode 2 and is now going to reverberate throughout the whole season.
So effective.
That's gutsy in terms of doing it that way and having that just be inescapable going forward for whatever else they do forward. Apparently over the next 2 seasons from what they've announced so far. If I'm expecting that, as you already said, that Ellie will not be able to escape the cycle of violence, and the rest of the show is going to be a tragedy in motion of seeing a person that had hope of being different, who had a father that in some ways found a way to be different despite his numerous crimes, however you wish to judge them in the past, see that she's going to fall into the same problems, same tropes as the person that she's pursuing, and innocent people are going to be hurt in the process. Obviously, Abby's friends aren't innocent. As you said, at minimum, they are feckless in terms of not opposing what they're viewing as their friends' unjustifiable actions and murderous tendencies, whatever else. And I'm almost wondering that by the end of this, make a prediction if we're just going to compound the tragedy. Ellie's going to be able to hurt Abby's friends, but for some reason, Abby's going to either escape or not. Ellie's not going to be able to reach her. And so they're both in some ways going to be left alone, having lost all their friends. And yet she won't be able to fulfill even the revenge that she just ruined her life over. And that would just compound the tragedy kind of the show, whatever else. Because they've set up that in many ways, the people that are around are two now main characters. And I don't think I'm going to mention a limb to say that Ellie and Abby are now going to be the main characters of this show.
Agreed.
Are in some ways more sympathetic or more likable or more easy necessarily to like than our two leads are. And I think the show's going to really pour some salt in the wound at making them the victims ultimately of our main characters' revenge quests. Is that they're going to lose the people that they still had that they loved in their desire to seek some measure of revenge for the harm and what they lost.
Should we go into segments?
Please. Do you want to do winners and losers, or do you want to do quotes first?
I got a loser in mind.
You know, you're famous for going out on a limb with this, for picking the one that no one
big
would
loser
see coming, for
big loser of the episode. Tommy. No, I'm kidding. Joel, obviously big loser of the episode. RIP Joel. I needed to happen, and they delivered. They did it, and it was effective.
Yeah, fallback plan there, Ellie, because dear God, did what she had to go through. And this is where I watched a few reactions of people online, because I was curious to see how the broader fandom was interpreting this beyond just simply, you know, 10 years ago, seeing how the video game community did. And the majority of people are like uncontrollably angry at Abby and actively weeping for Ellie. And I'm not fully there.
No.
I'm very sad for Ellie.
No.
But I'm kind of looking at this going that it's fucked up what she did, and dear God, what Ellie's going through, but a certain element of, fair play. Like, you know, I get it, Abby, why Abby went to do this, and I have a certain degree of discomfort or anger at Joel in terms of what he did at the end of season one, as we've discussed. So I'm not fully there when it comes to how a lot of people are reacting when it comes to the events at the end of this episode, but that said, dear God, what Ellie went through is utter hell. So I think we have to include Ellie as being a co-loser of the episode because Joel's dead. There's a certain element of peace in that. Ellie's got to now live with this shit.
Yeah, there's a phenomenon in professional wrestling where they'll set up a babyface and a heel. Mm-hmm. And they'll set up sometimes a heel that has a long, successful career. Maybe been a babyface for a long time, switched heel, you know, done a lot for the industry. Fans know really well, but is playing a heel. In a particular match, and the fans will start to cheer for that person, and they're not cheering for that particular character. They're cheering for the history, the background of that person. And it's, you know, Rock Hogan at WrestleMania. We just had one last night in WrestleMania 41 where John Cena, Cody Rhodes, John Cena is the heel, but you know, John Cena's wrestled for 20 years, right? Mm-hmm. And the fans in the arena are supposed to be booing for John Cena, and they cheer when he wins, because despite the story, they're going with this guy. And mm-hmm. that if I don't know the internet's reaction, I'm not seeking it out, but me, I'm Rock Hogan with Abby. Like, I know I'm supposed to be booing Abby, but I'm going to kind of be rooting for Abby as we go. Is Abby a psychopath? Absolutely. What she did was heinous. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't support it. If I was one of her friends, I would have stopped her. I like to think I would have anyway. Mm-hmm. But I get it. I'm sympathetic. And I hope that she doesn't have a miserable rest of her life.
I very much sympathize probably with what the actress is going to go through. Because I remember this, you know, 10 years ago when The Last of Us Part 2 came out. The actress who played Abby in the video game, Laura Bailey, very, very good voice actress, who played one of the nurses in that operating scene. Again, bringing back voice actors from the game in terms of the show. She got abject, like, hell. Like, people stalked her with death threats kind of shit. In terms of what? Again, The internet was apoplectic.
What are so? Hold on. So this is like a Joffrey thing. Like people are that mad at Abby. Like I'm that.
God, yeah.
So I'm way out.
At least in the video game, yeah. I don't know.
I'm calling her fucking. You know, I'm calling her John Cena from last night. Like that, she's like supposed to be the heel, but we all cheer for her. What you're telling me is that like she's the demonstrable villain of the zeitgeist. Like people are absolutely against her.
Like not in a way I think the video game intended, kind of thing. Because like the makers of the video game had to come out in support of, okay, you can process how the video game is portraying events however you want, but please stop attacking the voice actress for just doing
well,
a good job.
Well,
that's unforgivable.
That's so beyond the pale and stupid. But I don't understand a universal reaction against Abby. I would think it'd be more 60-40.
It seemed like from what, again, I'm talking 10 years ago in terms of how I remember this. But from what I remember, it was like 95-5 in terms of people that were trying to speak in either understanding of Abby versus they were like, if this game does not end with her burning alive on fire while being consumed by maggots, I will not be content. It was that level of, maybe it was just the loudest voices on the internet, but that's what I kind of remember of the zeitgeist in terms of responding to what they saw.
That's so, I'd love to hear our listeners' thoughts on this. I mean, as you're listening to this, or as you're watching the show, are you just like mortified by Abby? Are you angry at Abby? Are you sympathetic at all? Because I'm watching this feeling a certain measure, a large measure of sympathy for her.
I'd love to know how the video game did this and whether the show's doing it differently, but it's just given us grounds to have sympathy. She's the first character we saw in the show, in the season. We've gotten to see several scenes of her interacting with friends and her friends being uncomfortable and her watching her dreams. Did the video game just not have any of that? Is all that added in, or did people not care? It seems like, at least from what I'm seeing of the television reaction, people are not at that level of pissed, but they still want her dead.
Perhaps because they did the Joel shooting, they thought it was okay. Like because they were the character, it was more sympathetic. But like, that wasn't an okay thing for Joel to do, folks. Like I don't get it, but it is good to know. Thank you for bringing that to the podcast. Who are the winners this week?
I'm going to say Tommy and Maria, and as representatives of the broader Jackson community, the fact that Jackson Hole stood and still stands is that is the kind of, you know, that's like we won in World War II level of we're going to celebrate that as the greatest generation thing. If they're not talking about this moment for the next 100 years of I was there that day and I survived and I stood and I fought alongside these heroes, I don't understand this community. They overcame in a way that should be the talk of legends. And the fact that Tommy and Maria are the leaders of that community they're going to be, if they are not mythologized within a few years, I don't understand how this world is working. So them and the community they represent are, in my mind, the uncontestable winners of this episode.
I think they're winners too, but you keep talking about like what'll happen in 5, 10, 30 years. I think there's a chance that this shit might happen again in 2 weeks.
I hope not, but maybe.
Like, I'm not sure that this is a one-shot deal. Like they may get, you know, a bunch of infected running up against them again pretty soon.
If so, I hope they're able to rebuild, because what they did worked. Barely, but it worked. And I'm hoping they're going to get some measure of peace as a result of this, because it seems like they eradicated the broader infected population of Idaho, Wyoming, and Utah. But don't know that. As you said, this could just be a Tuesday in this universe. They're certainly prepared for it like it's a Tuesday.
Abby, Friedrich Nietzsche. Whoever fights monsters should see to it that in the process he does not become a monster. And if you gaze long enough into an abyss, the abyss will gaze back into you.
Yeah. I feel like we have to mention Abby's in some ways is a twisted honorable mention of winners of where she accomplished every one of her
big
objectives.
Big winner. Not honorable mention. Blue ribbon winner. Shout out.
Yeah, but it's... No. Come on. The show is setting this up that she's gotten no measure of satisfaction from this. This is not going to quiet her demons. I think the show's statement on revenge is that she got what she wanted. It's just not actually going to be anything that improves her life.
Have you ever once in your life seen somebody get revenge and go, well, that was great. I'll go about a healthy life now.
No, that's not how that works.
It never does that way. No, of course not. I mean, forgiveness is the only way to get that level of peace, but you understand it, and she did accomplish it. She accomplished her goal. It was high performance.
From an on-paper objective standpoint, she is the only one that won this episode.
My goodness. All right, you got some quotes for me?
I do. The initial back and forth banter between Ellie and Jesse is just great. It's wonderfully humanizing. It feels very real. I like that it's twisting and subverting tropes. I got to give an honorable mention to that. I don't think it's going to be my quote of the episode because I don't think it's necessarily in keeping with kind of the overall message of the show and like what we like to pick for quotes of the episode, but it was just a well-done series of dialogue going back and forth on what did you do last night? Why did you do that? And then ending with, you know, it's kind of fucked up you did that, though, when he walks away smiling. All very well done. Back and forth between also now Ellie talking with Jesse. My shit with Joel is complicated. I know that. From the outside, it probably looks really bad. It has been really bad. But I'm still me, and he's still Joel, and nothing's ever going to change that, ever. So you can all stop talking about it, stop worrying about us, and thinking about us, all right? And ending with later, now, if you don't mind, I'm going to go on patrol with him like it's fucking daddy-daughter day. It was very real. It was very well done. It also is just emphasizing the tragedy. I'm with you. My read of this is that they never got to talk again, and she's just now looking forward to it. Of course, she's established a measure of peace, an understanding of herself that she wasn't willing to kind of have that conversation before, and she's now willing to talk with Joel and reestablish a relationship again after 5 years, but now she'll never get to do so. And so the tragedy that is just seeping in that line in retrospect is just well-handled show, well-handled. More in keeping with the themes of the episode, back and forth between Joel and Abby, I saved your life, and she just merely responds, what life? Abby, I get it. Dear God, what you went through is heinous beyond all understanding, but you're surrounded by four friends, right? 1, 2, 3, 4?
That's right. Yeah.
That just crossed the country with you for the purpose of just supporting you. That you apparently have established a new life. What was the organization they were with? WLF, something in Seattle. You've established a new home. You've got new leadership. You're apparently equipped with military gear you didn't have before over the last 5 years. You have the measures of having a life. You've just been unwilling to live it. And that feels very much in keeping with the themes of revenge the show wants to explore, where someone who becomes so target fixated on what has been done to them, what they have lost, that they're incapable of moving forward or even seeing what they have. And that line felt like it summarized it well. The entire back and forth between Abby and Joel, of her monologue speech, of when, you know, goes into describing him, talks about what he took away from her, talks about that she saw her dad at all of 19, and that she's been in the militia, she has a code. We don't kill people that can't defend themselves, and right now that's you. But I'm going to kill you. Because it doesn't matter if you have a code like me, or you're a lawless piece of shit like you. There are just some things everyone agrees are just fucking wrong.
But that was like a nonsense line, right? Because she went about killing him.
I agree. It's twisted. It's inconsistent. It's the rant of a person that prepared this, but is now struggling in the moment of delivering it. Because maybe in some ways she never thought she'd actually get here. But the actress does it very well. It felt really, really real. I like that in some ways it's almost acknowledging its inconsistency in terms of what she's doing compared to the values that she already supposedly has and how she's trying to make herself different from him. But there's a certain element of, there's no logic behind this. There's no hope for this. There's no peace that's been achieved by this, but I'm going to do it anyway because I have to. I liked that. I liked that, again, it's in going into the psychology of revenge that the show seems to want us to explore. And ending a little bit later with Joel finally just telling her, hey, I would murder you all of you if I can, but I've come to peace that I can't, and, you know, that I did some fucked up shit. Could you just, shut the fuck up and do it already. Stop monologuing. And a very cold line from her, from Abby. You stupid old man, you don't get to rush this. Delightfully cold, well delivered. That was another good line for me. I think that's all the lines I wrote down from the episode. Do any of those work for you as a line of the episode?
Not a big dialogue episode. Not a lot of monologues going on here. I am going to pick a very simple line because it tells us where we're going. It's the last line, second or third to last line of the episode from Ellie. Quite simply, I'm going to kill you.
Sold. That works.
I think that's the way to do it, because it's not a dialogue heavy episode, and I think that's the one that will stick with me is her on the floor looking up yelling, I'm going to kill you, to Abby.
It's notable too that Ellie basically knows nothing about who these people are or why they did this. From her perspective, she just walked into a room and five random people are killing her father.
So
doesn't know why, doesn't know what occurred. Dina knows a little, not much. She basically just knows she saw, they like focused on her seeing the WLF patch and that they rescued Abby. So she almost knows enough to hang herself because I think she's going to be more misled about what happened. But Ellie knows less in some ways than Abby did as to why Joel got killed. And Abby doesn't know that much either.
So as you were preparing our segments and talking, I was able to look something up that I suspected and I have verified it. And I think it's important to this discussion. I wish I'd have known it before. So in the video, the reason I think the people in the video game were so fucking angry is Abby does not get introduced until Joel rescues her.
Oh.
So Joel rescues this person, and then this person takes him back to the cabin, and then this person tortures and fucking kills Joel. And you don't know anything other than what she's saying in the moment, whereas the TV show introduces her backstory earlier to connect why she's doing the things she's doing, making her more sympathetic.
That is so night and day different. I can't imagine that is anything other than
a reaction. I don't know if it's a reaction to the reaction.
Yeah, I don't know if course correcting is maybe too hard of a term, but it feels very much like either they're trying to avoid the shitstorm that resulted in the video game, or they don't think what they were trying for in the video game would work on television, and it would be even harsher on television. I don't know which, but I have to say, how could we interpret that as anything other than intentional in terms of so differently structuring how we're presented this character?
I don't like it. I think they should have played it rough. Like, just give me the random ass girl who just fucking kills you. Like, that would have been wild to watch on television, especially with a show that's this important to HBO and that has this big a budget. I can see why they softened it. Right. But certainly makes Abby much more sympathetic than it. I mean, if you had, he had just saved her, and then she did that. I mean, I can see just being really frustrated.
The show is now setting her up as in some ways a co-protagonist, a villain, an antagonist to our main character, but having her own story that we're otherwise also following. For the video game, though, I unless we get to spend some time with her later, at this point we would just see her as nothing other than a dyed-in-the-wool psychopathic villain.
This is what I'm saying, is that she's John Cena from last night. She's supposed to be bad, but there's so much sympathy that sometimes your co-protagonist, you're cheering for her when you're not supposed to be, maybe. But I, now knowing that they've made that change, maybe they do kind of want you cheering for her. So I don't really know what they want out of the audience reaction to the Abby character. I can say they've created a compelling character here. I'm interested in where she goes. I want to keep following her. And I would place her at a plus 300. And I'm going to put Ellie at minus 300 here in this battle. I think the smart
never square off.
Smart money's on Ellie long term, but we'll see.
If it ever came to just the two of them are locked in a room and only one can survive, obviously Ellie wins that.
Yep.
What element of strategic long term planning kind of thinking Ellie has? She's intelligent. She's physically capable, but this seems a bit of a foreign world for her and what she's now setting off to do. So I would give Abby some advantages there, and just in terms of the process of revenge is something Abby's lived for 5 years and Ellie's just now stumbling into.
But they have laid the kernel. They've laid the seed, Spencer. Dina really liked Joel too.
Yeah, there's a personal motivation there. And
Dina will Jesse be a part of this, yeah.
Again, I'm expecting it's going to be the trio that sets out. I'm with you. I would almost find it, as much as Tommy's very much going to be affected by this, I think I would find it weird if he just leaves everything behind and goes off to go kill Joel's murderers right now.
With these kids. No, it's not happening. He's staying
there. With his kids, with his community. He was unwilling to set off at the end of the season because of his responsibilities. This will be a further test of that, but I'm expecting it's going to be Ellie, Dina, Jesse that go off to do this.
I agree. I think we're going to find that out next episode, or certainly by the end of the season. Spencer, anything else you want to say wrapping up this banger of an episode, this like absolute fork in the road for the show?
It leaves me excited. I mean, it was such a great episode. It was such a surprise. It was so well executed. Again, I won't go as far as to say I was lukewarm on episode one, but I wasn't overexcited by it.
6.18, I believe you gave it.
If I was to give this one a score, we're pushing into the eights kind of range, maybe even the upper eights kind of thing, just in terms of it was really freaking well done. And it's overall gutsy for the season, for the overall story, to do it the way they did and to balance it how they did in terms of the action occurring in the community, but also the drama occurring with respect to these individual characters, separate and apart from the action. To make an A and a B plot work in this element of spectacle, that even just structurally is hard to do, but I feel like they did it really well. So, yeah, this episode's really hitting a lot of the marks.
Yeah, I agree. I'd put it at a 8.325.
We've talked about this, man. You need further decimals. I appreciate your trying, but we'll see. I want a few more from you next week if you can do that for me.
I'll work on it. I'm excited. I'm excited for where the show's going to go. They delivered. They gave me the thing that I wanted to see this season. It's gutsy, and I'm excited about the rest of the season. We will review season 2, episode 3 next week. I'll be doing the podcast from lovely Maui, Hawaii. I'm excited to do that. I'll be off in Maui.
Have you checked how many hours different we're going to be when we try to record this?
Yeah, I'm 6 hours behind you, so it'll work great. I'll just do it at like 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
Oh, sweet. Okay. Yeah, we can make this work. I was almost hoping it was going to be harder than that, but you know, okay, fine. Well, this will be tolerable.
So kind. You're such a good buddy. What a friend. I wish you were doing this at 4 in the morning.
Off Alaska for you for Game of Thrones. Come on. Don't throw
You absolutely did for a terrible ending of season 2 of House of the Dragon. You did it from a fucking cruise ship and did a video pod too, which is still up on YouTube. Shout out.
I paid $15 extra for that one day of better internet to make that happen, and that was the episode I did it for.
Podcast professional over here. Yeah, well, Spencer, you're an absolute delight. I enjoy doing this podcast with you. Thank you for being here today and talking about the seminal episode of Last of Us. We will be back next week to review season 2, episode 3. Let us know what you think. I threw out a question in the pod about how you're feeling about Abby. I would love to hear our listeners' thoughts about that. How does this character, how are you reacting to this character? Do you think she's a babyface? Do you think she's a heel? How do you feel about the change from the video game? We'd love to hear your thoughts. You can get it to us at facebook.com/mangumtalks or mangumtalkspodcast@gmail.com. mangumtalkspodcast@gmail.com. I will check it. Spencer will not, and I will get back to you. Thanks for listening. I hope everybody has a great week. See ya.